This is Ken Lubin, the host and founder of the Executive Athletes Podcast, and welcome to this week's episode. I want to thank everyone that's been listening, and thank you for the comments and feedback. They're awesome and an incredible help in this journey to making this podcast better and better each episode. Once again, this is unscripted and unedited, as I believe it is the best way to get to really know the guest. This episode's guest is Benita Fitzgerald Mosley. Benita is an established high-profile international leader in the sports and nonprofit industries, a visionary, results-oriented leader, and change agent. She has an impressive track record of transforming and growing organizations through innovation, increased revenues, and operational excellence. An Olympic gold medalist and accomplished business executive, Benita inspires and motivates high-performing teams to achieve world-class results. She's a passionate advocate for helping both youth and adults achieve their personal best life. Benita was most recently the CEO of Laureus Sports for Good Foundation USA, where she was charged with advancing the Laureus mission to improve the lives of youth and unite communities through the power of sport. Named a 2019 Notable Woman in Sports by Crain's New York Business and a 2015 Game Changer by the Sports Business Journal, Benita also serves on the International Olympic Committee Women in Sport Commission. A world-class athlete, Benita won a gold medal in the 100-meter hurdles in the 1984 Olympic Games in L.A., making her the second American woman and the first African-American woman to accomplish this feat. She was a member of the 1980 and 1984 U.S. Olympic teams, an alternate on the 1988 U.S. Olympic team, a gold medalist in the 83 Pan Am Games, an 8-time national champion, and 14-time NCAA All-America. So, Benita, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
So, Benita, you've done some amazing things. Your bio is great, but we'd just love to hear who Benita is from her own words.
Well, I am a passionate supporter of helping others achieve gold medals in their own lives. I feel like my gold medal is the gift that keeps on giving, and I want to pay it forward. And so I've done that in many aspects of my life and my career, and volunteer work for Women's Sports Foundation on their board of directors and as board chair. I've done it, doing it now at the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Museum board. I'm working with the Play Sports Coalition, which is a group of 3,600 new sports organizations across the country that are working to try to get relief after the pandemic, to return to play, and also to reimagine youth sports. I'm just trying to pay it forward, really using the gifts I've been given, the opportunities I've been given to help others do better in their lives as well.
Perfect. No, and that's exciting. And I love your focus on youth. And let's jump right into that. Youth sports during this pandemic. It's a crazy time. And I think the listeners have heard this in the story, but my youngest kid was ski racing on Saturday and the race got canceled because of wind. And then that afternoon at 3:30 on Saturday afternoon, the world of ski racing was shut down. And I'm sure every other sport in the same, you know, that same weekend or within a couple of days, it was over. What are you seeing out there with youth sports, and are they going to be the same when we come out of this?
Well, I'll tell you what I've been seeing, but as far as when we come out of it, I hope they're not the same. I actually hope they're better. And the reason I say that is that I actually have been reappointed to a different commission with the International Olympic Committee called Sport and Active Society. It used to be called Sport for All and Sport for All Commission. And I believe in sport for all, but the problem is that everybody doesn't have equal access to sport throughout the country. And you and I, you know, growing up playing sports and our kids play sports and they have access to any kind of sport opportunity, training, coaching, travel teams, et cetera, that we could probably avail to them. A lot of kids don't have that opportunity. And so what I'm seeing during this pandemic is not only are the travel sports shut down, the tournaments and the championship events, high school sports, middle school sports are all shut down. But also community-based sports programs, those kind of sports-based youth development programs that my former organization, Laureus USA, really supports and promotes that reach kids in underserved communities that otherwise wouldn't have access to sport. And the challenge is, because of the economic downturn that's has accompanied the pandemic, you have local school districts obviously shut down, but also cutting their budgets. You have local parks and rec cutting their budgets. And so it's a cascading challenge of not having access to the top level youth sports programs, but now all of the bottom is already cut out as well. The grassroots sports are being cut out as well. And that's what's going to have a more lasting impact on those kids.
No, and that's the whole thing, right? And I think that's probably the more important piece of this when it comes back to normal is supporting the grassroots foundations, because we all know the club teams, we all know those teams will come back, you know, no issues because there's the funding and people can pay for it. But the grassroots piece, I think, is probably the most important piece.
Yes, indeed.
And without grassroots, we don't have what we have today, right? We don't have elite athletes. We don't have opportunities for individuals that are out there and really moving forward. So tell us a little bit about what you're doing at Laureus, because Laureus is a pretty unique organization. I think it's probably more focused in Europe than it is here in the U.S., but give us some insight into that.
Yeah, I spent the last 4 years really trying to raise the profile of the organization, grow both, you know, in revenues, but also in impact, the kids that we were able to reach and support here in the United States. It's a organization that's been around 20 years. It was founded really under the auspices of two organizations, Daimler, which is Mercedes-Benz parent company, and also Richemont. Worldwide, and it's a luxury goods company that really owns Cartier and Piaget and Van Cleef and Montblanc. So those two companies founded Laureus 20 years ago, and it was really inspired by our founding patron, Nelson Mandela, who said, sport has the power to change the world. It has the power to inspire. It speaks to youth in a language they understand. It's more powerful than governments in overcoming racism and racial barriers. So, you know, in that spirit, Laureus was born and really works across the world in 40 different countries to bring sport to kids in underserved communities, but not only sport, but to use it as a tool for social change in those communities, whether it's, you know, helping people that are in warring nations come together through basketball program, or helping youth in South Africa be introduced to surfing and get out of their neighborhoods, or in the United States, in Chicago or New York or Atlanta, in the poorest neighborhoods there, to help kids, introduce them to tennis and to skateboarding and to dance and yoga, and also teach them the life skills that they need to be successful long term.
And that's, I think, probably one of the most important things about sport, right? And we all know people aren't going to become, you know, like you and become an Olympic gold medalist, right? Or a professional baseball player, football player, whatever it is, I think. But the lessons that sport can teach the youth is unbelievable. It's grit. It's determination. It's learning how to win. And I think that's, hopefully, coming out of this pandemic, people sort of get back to really what that is versus just, oh, my kid's going to be the next Division I, whatever. And the likelihood of that are minimal anyways, right? Or a professional athlete or whatever. And hopefully this sort of regrounds everything and resets this. And hopefully this is headed in the right direction.
I hope so too.
So what are you seeing in the Olympic movement, right? What I failed to mention prior to, in your bio is that you're high level at the USOC as well, and Olympic track and field for sports performance. And where do you see the Olympic sports playing into things? I'm a big fan of Olympic sports. I actually like them better than most of the other, most of the professional sports that are out there, because it's more raw than a lot of the other. They're less entertainers than they are. Yes. Athletes, right? They're more athletes than entertainers. Where do you see the Olympic sport movement going and growing, or is it going sideways, or what's happening there?
Well, I mean, that I think sport in many ways served as a bellwether for this pandemic. You know, once the NBA, Major League Baseball, NHL suspended their seasons, And then ultimately, a few weeks later, the Olympics postponed the games until 2021. I mean, that really let the world know that this thing is serious and it's for real, right? And so I've spoken with several current athletes who were training for 2020. A few of them, like Simone Biles and Allyson Felix, were planning to retire, you know, at the end of this year, or maybe at the end of World Championships next year. And so that's requiring them to stay in another year or two in the sport. And, you know, they're getting older. And so I think for many athletes thinking about this next year, it seems like, oh, it's just another 12 months. But yeah, it's another 12 months.
Exactly.
And in the life of an Olympic athlete, it's a long time. And so my prayer is that, you know, the Olympic Games will actually take place next summer. It would be devastating to the Olympic movement if, in fact, they ended up being canceled. And so I know it's a logistical nightmare for the IOC, for the Tokyo Organizing Committee, for the National Olympic Committees all over the country, all over the world, and the international federations and governing bodies to really reset their calendars. If you're talking about Tokyo, find hotel rooms and get the venues reopened and everything else that they probably had other plans for in 2021. But I do hope that the athletes stick to it and can come back, you know, again, better than ever, and will regain their tenacity and their kind of motivation to really come back stronger than ever and really do a great job in Tokyo.
And that's going to be tough, like you said, 12 months, because they're going into this year where, you know, peaking in three, right? Ready to peak. And then all of a sudden it's like, uh-oh, my peak now just got out 12 months. Talk to as an
Olympic athlete. And not only that, but their training just ended. Like right? For weeks there, they had no access to gyms or weights or, you know, or needed to be inside their homes. And you know, some got donated equipment, you know, from friends and family. Others were able to kind of go to a lone training facility by themselves with just their coach and train. But most didn't have access to the mountain or the travel or the competitions that they needed, you know, to stay in and or get in shape. So it's challenging at best for them. Yeah.
And as an Olympic athlete, talk to us about, you know, the mental piece of that, because that's going to be sort of crazy.
It is. It's difficult. You know, I remember when I was competing, even to go from the semifinals to the finals, I'd much rather run the semis and then come back an hour later and run the finals while my adrenaline's still going and I'm still amped up and warmed up, as opposed to having a day in between where you have to come back down and back up. And this is the kind of thing. I know it's over a protracted period of time, but you're right. I mean, they were ready, peaked, and focused on their peak performance in Tokyo. And psychologically and mentally, they've got to reset. Also, the kind of economic impact on these athletes. Some of them have postponed having a career and transitioning out of sport into their careers and have been kind of holding on financially for some years. And now they've got to find the resources to continue to train and pay their living expenses over the next 12 to 15 months. In addition, the National Olympic Committees are hurting as well. The U.S. Olympic Committee laid off over 100 people a couple of weeks ago. Some took deals, some, you know, early retirement or whatever, and others were laid off. And it has a trickle-down effect then to the USA track and fields of the world. U.S. rowings and table tennises and gymnastics that depend on funding from the USOPC to run their programs.
Right. And that's a whole other piece where, you know, where do you see that going with these governing bodies that are, you know, running out of money? And I know a lot of athletes have to raise their own money, right, in order to go to the games. And unlike professional sports, most of them have day jobs then have to go train early morning, go work their, stand on their feet, go work their day job, and then go, you know, back at the end of the day to go train again. Where do you see, you know, and that's one of the challenges with funding for the, you know, the Olympic sports. you know, why do you think, or why is there such a challenge there? I've never really talked to anyone about that. Why is there such a challenge with that? Because I know most countries will fund that when we're probably the only one who's privately funded it.
Right. Yes. The U.S. Olympic and Paralympic committees, nor the, and the national governing bodies of the various Olympic sports here in the U.S. receive no government funding. And it's a, it's both a source of pride, but also, you know, a source of consternation, I think, for those organizations, because other countries do have more kind of federated model, if you will, or federal model. Here, we don't have a ministry of sport. The USOPC kind of serves in that capacity as kind of the overseer per the Amateur Sports Act from 1978, that they have responsibility for overseeing Olympic and now Paralympic sport in the United States. And so it's up to, you know, donations and corporate engagement and broadcasters who donate money and provide funding to the IOC and to these governing bodies. And then for the athletes, being able to find a way to scrape together their living expenses. If you think about an Usain Bolt or Simone Biles or Michael Phelps, absolutely, you know, they're making plenty of money. But even if you look at someone like Allyson Felix, who's one of the most decorated Olympians in the history of the world, and, you know, she has a baby and gets dropped by her sponsor, right? So it's that kind of tentative situation for many of these athletes. Thankfully, she's got kind of a new sponsor and she's training again and able to continue. But, you know, someone with lesser credentials than she would have been very devastated by such a thing. And it's happening all over the place. You don't, you know, maintain your performance year over year, you get dropped, your payments get lowered by your sponsors. And so you get injured and have to recover, you get, you know, reduced by your sponsors. And so if you have them at all, and that's for something like track and field, it's a marquee sport in the Olympic Games. Others like wrestling or table tennis, those athletes are just scraping by. They are very highly dependent on Olympic training centers and like you said, part-time or full-time jobs in order to survive.
No, it's, yeah, and I know, like, the U.S. ski team guys, they, if you're not on the A team, you have to go out and raise money in order to travel, right, and covering your expenses and everything else, and it's a big deal, and it's not a small number that you have to go raise in order to pull this stuff off. And I, you know, and I know some people in crew or similar that are, you know, not, yes, say, in the, you know, on the A boat or whatever, it's the same thing to chase your dreams.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So what about when sport's over and making that transition? I'm sure this is, you know, it's a challenge for everyone because you're shifting from one identity to a second identity. Talk to us about that transition. Talk to about how you did it, but, you know, more importantly, that psychological piece of going from athlete to no longer athlete.
There's so many layers to that transition. And for most athletes, they haven't had the luxury of being able to have two careers kind of going at the same time. So developing a business career or whatever field of endeavor they want to pursue alongside, you know, their pursuit of Olympic glory or NFL glory or NBA glory, right? So what happens is the lights go down, the crowd stopped cheering, and the athletes then went from being at the very pinnacle of their careers in athletics to now having to be at the, you know, very bottom of whatever career it is they're trying to pursue and have to work their way back up that ladder. And that psychologically is a tough thing. It's tough to not have the travel and the adulation and the attention that you're used to and afterwards. Financially, if you're in one of the pro leagues and you've made millions of dollars, at least you don't have that challenge. But other athletes, if you don't have another career that you've developed, then you're going from whatever income you had at that sport to zero. And so... my advice, you know, to athletes is to try if at all possible, to have some concurrent process going on so that you don't drop off a cliff when you decide to hang up your spikes or your swim goggles or your, you know, your basketball shoes, that there you've spent some time taking advantage of all of the exposure that you get from a media standpoint, from standpoint of being exposed to CEOs and presidents of companies. The opportunities that come your way, and be prepared to do that. And so that's a way for athletes to, again, make a little bit smoother transition. It doesn't necessarily help with the psychological aspect of losing that part of your identity, but the fact that you have another identity to claim when it's all over does help distract you a little bit and help you pursue some additional goals.
And I think too, now it's almost easier than before if you pay attention, right? You can become so-and-so on social media. You have the ability to market yourself way more than, you know, your generation did, or even my generation. Absolutely. Coming out of school in the 90s, right? It's like you didn't have anything unless you had newspaper articles that you could go get microfiche from and take pictures of. And now, my day job is I'm an executive recruiter, and I do the same thing with people that say they want to even make a transition in their own career. It's like, hey, you got to build your brand. You got to build Benita. You got to build Ken. You got to build Bobby. You got to build Susie, because that's who you are at this point, right? You're no longer Olympic athlete, pro athlete. You are who you are. And that's a hard thing to do, because, you know, at that point, you are that person. And it's the same thing with executives who either get fired or they have, you know, there's issues that go in there because their identity is no longer gone, because in sport, in business, in medicine, in all of this, it's, we've, as a society, have become, you're an athlete, you're a doctor, you're a businessman. Well, in reality, you're Ken, you're Allison, you're Bobby, right? That's who you really are. And taking that identity piece, you know, in shifting that mindset is difficult, but it's doable.
So when I was at the U.S. Olympic Committee, I created the Athlete Career and Education Program called ACE Program. And in doing so, really revitalizing some programs that had been in place years prior, and some partners that they had on the education side and on the kind of athlete career consultation side of things, but adding, you know, a lot more programs and services and support to athletes. And that program is still up and running and really going gangbusters. And it's a different way of helping athletes that want to be entrepreneurs, that need to get an undergraduate or graduate degree, that need career counseling just to figure out who I want to be when I grow up, or to help them with the transition from a job placement standpoint. So, you know, there are tools out there. I think each of the professional leagues has very robust programs as well. And I think what athletes, again, my advice is that they really need to focus some years before they're ready to retire, spend some portion of their day. And I know they're focused on either working or working out, training, competing, and traveling. I know it's a lot, but the fact that we can do a lot of this remotely now, a lot of stuff you could do at midnight or 6 a.m. or 5 p.m. It's not time dependent. And so, you know, really finishing that degree, getting that graduate degree, doing that internship, those kinds of things that you can do, and taking advantage of the resources that they have at their disposal, in addition to building their brand on social media, I think is really important.
And like, I loved what you said, you can do it at midnight, you do it at 6 a.m., you can do it when you're sitting at the airport, when you're trying to just get stuff done. And that's what a lot of it is. It's sort of that do things when you don't have time, right? That sort of no extra time. And you forget that sitting at the airport for an hour, you can get more done in an hour sitting at the airport with a set of headphones in, and all of a sudden you just get a day's worth of work done because you know you have to get it done before you get on the flight, right? You know, those are great. And I love those suggestions there that you made. What about for the aspiring athlete, right? You know, you've worked your way to the pinnacle of sport. What suggestion would you give to the aspiring athlete that is sort of moving their way up through, you know, through the funnel and trying to get to that highest level?
I think that, you know, for me, it's both being aspirational and a bit grounded in reality at the same time. It's a hard kind of wire to walk, but I think the first and foremost is to have big dreams, own those big dreams, and the career advice I was giving you, there hopefully are opportunities before you that you can take advantage of. I have two kids who were student athletes in high school. My daughter is still running track and volleyball, playing volleyball in high school and club volleyball as well, and you know, running postseason meets. And so she, she's quite talented, but I see that if you're giving 100, this is giving 100%, she's probably around the 75 to 80%, right? And my thing is, no matter what you pursue in life, you don't want to have regrets. And I think in order to not have regrets, you really do have to take full advantage of the opportunities that are before you. If that's something you say you want to do, then you really want to go for it. Go for the gold. And sometimes the gold is making the high school team. Sometimes it's, you know, making it to the district or regional championship. Sometimes it's playing club and going to the national. Sometimes it's being recruited and playing Division I, II, or III college sports. Sometimes it ultimately is playing pro or going to the Olympic Games. But wherever that career will take you, I feel like people need to know they left it all out there on the playing field, one. And two, understand that even if I'm transitioning, as my son did, from playing high school sports but not playing in college, or playing college sports and not playing after that, or going to the Olympics and then retiring, at any point there's a transition, those same issues will arise. That same sense of loss and kind of grief that you feel of losing a part of your identity still happens. And so I think preparing yourself for that transition is as important for a high school kid who's hanging up their spikes at the end of their senior year to someone who is finishing a 15-year MBA career. It is a similar loss.
No, that, and I love that, Benita. That was great, because I think, you know, yeah, always have to be thinking ahead, but don't be afraid to lay it on the line, because if you throw up at the end, that's not a bad thing. You laid it all out. That's as fast as you can go. Whether or not you won or not, you know, that's as fast as you've gone.
That's as much as I could have done. Hard as I could have trained. And I don't mean overtrain. I'm not trying to say people need to.
No, not at all. Right.
Yeah, but when you put the effort in, when you're at practice, you know, when you're in that competition, just lay it all out there, because I have very few regrets in my athletic career. But I do, probably one that I probably didn't pursue it through 1992, kind of retired after 88 and tried to kind of halfway to come back. I probably would have gone till at least 92. Second thing is, I should have pursued the 400-meter hurdles in addition to the 100-meter hurdles. People told me that was really my event. I could own that worldwide, but it wasn't that. It wasn't even in the NCAA my first couple of years running. And then it was added to that and added to the Olympic program later. But by then, I was tops in the world in the 100 hurdles. I kind of like, why am I going to run four times farther when I could just, but I could just run 100 hurdles? So, but I have few regrets, but I don't have any regrets that I didn't, you know, at least for the events that I was in and the time that I was competing, that I didn't give it my all.
That's awesome. I love that. So Benita, this was awesome. We're here in a half an hour. I know you've got a busy day, but where can people find more about you? Where can they reach out to you if they want to connect?
Yeah, definitely. LinkedIn's the best place to reach me now. It's the social media platform that I'm most active on. I'm getting more active. I am pursuing several different business opportunities and career opportunities, and I'm trying to, as I figure that out, that's where I'll be announcing kind of the next step, I guess, for me in my career.
the next transition that we're chatting about along the way.
Yeah, no, I'm excited. There's a lot of opportunities before me, and I'm really trying to take my time to figure out the next best thing for me.
Perfect. Perfect. And Benita, thank you. This was awesome. I really appreciate it. Appreciate your time. You've got some amazing insights. So thanks again for being part of this.
Thanks, Ken. I appreciate it.
And if anyone has any questions, comments, feedback, feel free to email me at kenwitheexecutiveathletes.com. Make sure you go subscribe to the podcast and take this insight that Benita gave all of us and go make it happen. And hopefully when this is aired, we're done with this whole COVID thing and we're out really, really training back in the gyms and the fields and things are headed back to normal. So keep hanging tight, keep pushing hard and making things happen. Thanks for listening.